This is Bill Bell Chambers, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 12th of December, 2011. Bill Bell Chambers, Part 1.
Well, William Henry Bell Chambers. I was born in Haverstoke, 10th of July,
1923. So you're now 88.
88.
And are you commonly called Bill?
Yes, these days. The family used to call me Will. But now everybody seems to call me Bill, so I don't mind.
What was your name? What was your common name when you were down in the Antarctic?
They called me Bill down there, yes.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about your parents. What did your father do?
My father was a Royal Marine. In fact, I come from a long line of Royal Marines. Grandfather, great-grandfather and great-great-grandpa. So, and he was also a marathon runner in the Royal Marines, and so he got special privileges. And,
Did you not fancy the Royal Marines yourself?
I would have gone into the Royal Marines, but I had poor eyesight, and I failed the medical.
Oh, so you did apply?
Yes, yeah.
At what age?
17, I was going. When I applied, I then tried to become a writer in the Royal Navy, because that was an easier job, easier from the medical point of view. But again, they would only offer me duration of the war, and I was looking for a career. So,
So what happened instead? Where did you end up in your first job?
Well, I then went to the recruiting office, volunteered for the Hampshire Regiment.
Oh, right. And did you see active service?
Oh, yes, in Italy and, well, North Africa and Italy, but mainly Italy. So that was an experience.
When you were demobbed, did you have a career in mind?
Well, I did. I was going to go into horticulture. But, in fact, I went to training college for a while. But then the land that my father had was confiscated to, with the Labour government to build a school, which they never built. They built housing on it in the end.
I can tell it still rankles.
Yeah, yeah. So I had to fall back on what I knew. And that was radio and the radar.
So how did you come to know about radio and radar? And that was from your war years?
Well, I was in the Hampshires, and there was a call for volunteers. I forget how it was worded at the time, and I thought, well, this sounds a good thing. So I volunteered, and they sent me to Swansea Tech to learn radio and I passed that, and then they sent me to radar school up in Bury in Lancashire. And I had various other college training, Leicester College of Art and Technology, Northampton Polytechnic in London. So I became a radar technician.
Had you had any earlier interest in that kind of world? Had you had a crystal set or snuggled under the blankets and listened to shortwave radio?
Not that I recall. No, I was more aviation-minded, actually, than it was completely new to me.
How did you take to it?
Well, initially, I found it hard going. but then, suddenly, it all clicked, and I made quite a lot of progress. And of course, in those days, it was all very hush-hush.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes, brave I was.
You signed the Official Secrets Act?
No, no, I didn't. Not as a soldier.
You were already covered?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm. What were they... Who was it hush-hush from?
Well, in general, I mean, even the local people never knew what went on in these training colleges, the army ones, like the one at Bury. The only freedom you had was on the more advanced courses at Leicester and Northampton Polytechnic, because there you were not dealing so much with radar, but as you were dealing with techniques.
How do you mean, Bill?
Well, you were learning about some of the advanced equipment, not as equipment, but as elements of the equipment, such as magnetrons and special valves and so on.
So you were dealing with the kind of latest technology, were you? Cutting edge. Before it was in common use.
Yes.
And I guess the trick was not to tell the Russians. Is that right?
Well, yes. Or the Germans, for that matter. Yes. So, I was attached to a searchlight unit using radar, and I thought it was a time when the bombing was coming to an end in London. I was north of London at near Stansted, and there wasn't much going on, so I volunteered for overseas service.
Oh, right, so I misunderstood. The radar work was during the actual war itself.
Oh, yes.
Right, I thought you were talking about post-war.
No.
Right, I understand perfectly why it was all hush-hush then. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Were you learning things that you were surprised at? I mean, did sometimes the technology take you by surprise that this was now possible?
I can't say I did. I mean, I knew it was all new. And advances were being made all the time. So, it was a case of continual updating of knowledge on what was the latest elements of the equipment.
How long were you there for?
Where?
At the training school, the radar training school.
Oh, well, I had several visits. I was... First of all, at Bury, I was there for about 3 months. I was also at Tri-Cross, Copsall Hall, in Tri-Cross.
Tri-Cross, yeah.
That was, again, several weeks.
So over that whole period of time that you were learning, could you actually see advances being made in that?
Oh, yes.
Window of time?
Yes.
Such as?
Well, I mean, the equipment that I was originally used to was rather crude in many ways. I mean, things like the cathode ray tube, you know, which is now superseded by them. But the cathode ray tubes that they made, the guns weren't very on the fish. On the cathode ray tube weren't very efficient, and consequently they used to put a ring round the end of the tube to encourage the electrons to impinge on the glass, because they couldn't get it to work. And of course that was 400 volts. There wasn't much current there, but quite often when you took the covers off, You touched this.
You got a shock.
Oh, yes, I got plenty of shocks initially. Yes.
So once the war was over,
You then stayed in that kind of work, in the radio radar work. Working for who?
Yes. They sent me to... I joined the Ministry of Aviation. They sent me to Heathrow. That was rather fun in those days because the old vehicles we had were all ex-war time vehicles, continually breaking down because we used to have to go between the airport and the transmitting station, which is Faggs Road, Feltham. And I dealt mainly with navigational aids, which have now been superseded. But also I had a spell at the transmitting station. That was fun because we were doing a watch system, you know, in those days. And I wasn't too familiar with the equipment there. But, it worked. Then they sent me up to Shetland Islands. I was looking after the navigational aids and the communications there. Everything from putting up new masts to answering the telephone sometimes.
What was your first awareness that there is a place on this planet called the Antarctic?
Oh, that was when I was a boy. I used to read about Scott and Shackleton at quite a young age, I suppose. Can't remember precisely, but... that really...
That captured you, your
imagination. Yes, it was always with me, you know that. And when the opportunity arose to go down, I took it.
Well, how did that opportunity arise? Because it sounds like you had quite a good career going.
I did, really. I was at a Birdlip radio station.
In Gloucestershire?
Yes. And I looked after the receiver side because there were two stations, the transmitting station, which was stationed far away. But we were doing North Atlantic radio telephone with aircraft. And the reason I left was I was a bit unhappy in some ways, I suppose, but I saw an advertisement in the Wireless Engineer. I don't think it's published today, but by the Royal Society, asking for people to apply for ionospheric research in Antarctica. And I didn't have much hope getting here.
Why not?
I didn't think my qualifications were good enough, actually.
Did you understand what ionospherics were by that point?
Oh, yes.
Right, so you'd worked with that kind of area?
Yes, because the frequencies that we were using were dependent upon the ionosphere. So
you had a working knowledge. You already had a working knowledge of the ionosphere?
Yes. Also, we had some cooperation there with what was Radio and Space Research Station. And Dr. Shearman from there used to come down to Birdlip quite often because he was interested in what was called backscatter. That is, some of the energy that is reflected off the Earth is also reflected back. Mm. Now, in this way, they could... the initial backscattering was from the Earth's surface or the sea. So, and then came back by the ionosphere. So I got on very well with him, and I learned a good deal more about the ionosphere through him. Mm.
So you and he had made a connection prior to the application for the job?
Yes, that's correct.
Was he on the board too?
No.
On the interview board?
No. No, the interview board was under the chairmanship of Wordy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. there was...
Sloman?
No, Sloman.
No?
He was Fitz.
Right.
Nothing to do with Fitz. Well, not in the direct sense, anyway. No, there was a representative of all the disciplines, different disciplines on the board. There was Met Office. I don't know whether... I'll find a book in a moment.
All right. So I get this right in my mind, did you apply to FIDS or did you apply to somebody else?
I applied to the Royal Society.
Right. And you were doing that work on behalf of FIDS?
No.
So there was no relationship at all?
There was no relationship at all, except Royal Society were using Crown agents.
Right.
Who also looked after FIDS.
What did you make of Wordy?
Oh, I liked Wordy. Yes, because he was probably about my age then, I don't know. But no, he was a very pleasant character. And as you might expect, he knew his Antarctic.
Mm. But you didn't, of course. Do you remember any of the questions they asked you? Was it a tough interview, or was it a gentleman's agreement?
Well, I was very nervous.
Yeah.
Particularly with the big wicks on this long table. No, I didn't have any difficulty with the questions. And I remember Sutton, I think it was, who was in charge of the Met Office at the time. He asked me whether I felt I could service the radar, which was used for tracking the balloons. And I told him I didn't doubt I could service it. So anyway, following that, they wrote and accepted me. And then, to my amazement, they gave me the leadership of the group.
I know it's a long time ago. It's 60 years ago now, so you may not remember, but did you ever get the sense that they were sussing you out as a human being to see what sort of chap you were, whether you'd cope with the claustrophobic conditions at Halliburton?
Well, there was an element of that, I think.
Yeah.
Because I can't remember the name of the chap that was on the board. They were asking questions which...
About your temperament?
Well, I suppose so. Now I recall that they did ask questions about it being isolated down there. And did I feel I could... live under those conditions and work with others, you know. And, yes.
And you got the letter saying, please come and join us?
Yes. Because I thought then I would have to leave the Ministry of Aviation, Civil Aviation. But then they wrote and said that they would get my secondment from the ministry, so that suited me fine. Yeah, and I think it suited them too.
So at that point, or shortly after that point, did you then know where you were going to go? Did you know you were going to go to Halley? Had you heard about the IGY? The International Geophysical Year.
Yes. Well, I knew it was the International Geophysical Year. but I don't think I knew until shortly after I had, amongst others, I had an invitation to go and see Fuchs.
Oh, right.
In Victoria Street. And that's when I learnt about the two expeditions going south together, and that we were going to Halley Bay and he was going to Shackleton.
Tell me about that process of getting down there in those days. I guess you sailed all the way.
Yes. Well, we left London Docks. Forgotten the name of it now. But it was near London Bridge. And we sailed on the Magadan, which was a new ship. And the Royal Society had a yacht, which they followed us downstream. It was quite a good crowd to send us off, actually. Butler's Wharf, that was the name of the place. And first stop was Madeira, and we stayed there, I think, about 36 hours. And then on down to Montevideo.
When you say we, was this the entire Halley base staff going down together?
Yes. And Fuchs' expedition.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. We stayed a few days in Montevideo and then went to South Georgia, where they were still whaling in those days. Mm. And we took on board a lot of Australian beef, I remember there. Just stowed it on the decks because it was cold, you know. That was pretty tough meat, that was. And then, of course, we went into the ice. That was a new experience because suddenly everything went calm as you approached the ice. It was evening time too, and the weather was quite good. Suddenly everything was calm, and that was very special. And then, of course, we were in the ice. But I must say that in reading, and I've reread it recently, Fuchs blames the sea ice for the delay in getting to Halley Bay, whereas in fact what happened was the Magadan, you could con the ship from the crow's nest. And the repeaters had to be synchronised. And what happened was that they conned the ship for a while from the crow's nest, and then they didn't resynchronise the two. The result was we turned south, right into the hard stuff. But he doesn't acknowledge it in his book. But that was the reason. Oh, of course, it wasn't Fuchs's fault.
No.
The crew's fault.
So when you got to Halley Bay, what actually was there in 90? Was it 56 you arrived at Halley Bay?
Yes, we got there, January 57.
Yeah.
Yes.
What was that? What was to be seen, if anything, at Halley Bay?
We steamed along the ice cliffs for a couple of days, I think it was. And then we landed, and of course, we also had the Totten coming down. She was ahead of us, actually, because she'd avoided the ice. One thing that struck me then, which hadn't struck me before, was how cold it was now. Although the sun was shining in it, because, you know, we were on a heated ship. So... in cabins, so it was quite nice. But, of course, the advance party had put up the hut.
Already, yes.
Yeah. And they were waiting for us when we came in. we then had to unload not only the Mega, but the Totten as well. And we only had these Ferguson tractors, which were terrible things, really.
In what way?
Well, they were... they were farm tractors. All they had was chains on, you know. They used to bog down. You couldn't pull a very heavy load, particularly if during the daytime, so quite often... we had to work at night time, so-called. It was daylight all the time. But when the surface was harder. But even so, we used to get bogged down. So, but anyway, I think it took us about 5 or 6 days to unload the two ships.
What kind of state was the hut in? How sophisticated was it? Or is that the wrong word completely?
It was largely a bare hut. They had the small power generators in the hut, which had to come out because we had a new hut to build for the diesel generators. We had a number of huts to build. There was the magnetic hut, the balloon hut, but what was obvious when we got there was that the snow already was well up the side of the hut, and there was a big wind scoop downwind from it. But, and of course, it had windows in. The last thing you wanted there. Quite early on, the hut got completely buried, and the only way out was through the roof. So that had to be constructed.
You say that the conditions in general in Halley Bay in 57 were a little different from those of the Scott and Shackleton expeditions you read about as a boy.
That was my view.
Yeah.
Yeah. It... I suppose the clothing was more advanced, but the... We were in a big bunk room. There were two bunk rooms, one with big, one small. And so that was that housed the all 22 of us. That was heated by stoves, and of course all the usual things like keeping the ventilators clear from snow and so on. But you had to do everything for yourself. Well, I mean, not just for yourself, but for everybody. Snow had to be melted for water. The toilet was a barrel set in the snow inside the hut initially, with just a wooden top made. And then when the barrel was full up, it had to be carted out. Now, of course, when the hut got buried, we couldn't no longer do that. So what we did was we made a big a drop by keep pouring boiling water down, melted a big hole, and we had to keep it going that way.
Inside the hut?
Inside the hut.
So there was a hole in the floor of the hut?
Yeah.
Down to the ice below?
Yeah. But in order not to... the only thing that was taken outside was we always used to use the pea can before we went to the... before we sat down, because otherwise that would have frozen down there in no time and made things difficult. So the only thing we took outside was the pea can.
What about other domestic things like washing clothes and even washing yourself?
Well, we had on the first occasion we had a bath, and that came around every 10 days, and that was the opportunity to wash your clothes and to have a bath. But of course you had to make the water ready for yourself. There were two of us normally on each day, each of the days. So you had to fill the tank, make sure it was heated properly for your bath and for washing the clothes.
How to get rid of the used bath water?
That was bailed out most of the time. It used to have to be bailed out and taken outside, because it didn't work satisfactorily just putting water down in the snow. Yes.
It does all sound rather fundamental.
Sorry?
It does all sound rather fundamental.
Yes, yes.
Did you take to that? Because how did you cope with those kind of primitive conditions, for want of a better phrase? Did you adjust to it naturally?
Oh, I think so. You have to be adaptable down there. If you can't adapt, you won't survive, I don't think. The second time I went down, we didn't have a bath. All we had was a watering can with a hose on the end. Mm. And you filled that with hot water and you had a shower.
You watered yourself.
Yes. Oh, dear.
So you had to build a hatch in the roof to get out of the hut?
Yes.
And a stepladder, I guess, inside?
Yeah. And, of course, that was convenient for the Aurora Observer as well. So, yeah.
But wasn't there a danger that the snow would settle on the hatch on the outside?
No, because it's mainly drift snow.
Oh, right.
And It normally drifted from the same direction. Occasionally we had a snowfall, but also the heat from the hut used to help to keep it clear, I think.
So what about the working conditions then? Because you had a set-up... was it a beastie you built, or...?
Well, we had what was called a beastie, yes, but we had other equipment as well. We had two transmitters, pulse transmitters. We had to set a number of small aerials for drifts to measure the drifts in the ionosphere. I had to erect a 75-foot mast for the ionospheric transmitter. I also built the feeders for the base transmitter and the aerial, put those aerial masts up as well.
Well, you're building this gear actually in the Antarctic?
We're putting the masts up, yes. We had to construct gantries to carry the insulators and the feeders. All the aerial masts that there were two big rhombic antennas that I built. So there were, that was 8 50-foot masts in the case of those. That's where my experience in Shetland came in useful. Yes. So they all went up without any great difficulty. But of course, the real problem was, I mentioned earlier there was this when the drift on the hut, there was the downwind, there was the hollow, and of course that soon filled in once the hut was buried, and of course then the strain came on the stays on the mast. There was always something to do there.
Were you getting interesting results from your ionospheric experiments?
Oh, yes.
Were you actually doing... was this the first ionospheric work in the Antarctic?
No, it was the first at Halley Bay.
Right.
Previously, there was one... Well, it was at the same time, at Port Lockroy. That was the highest latitude one at that time.
So what kind of results were you getting which impressed you?
Well, we could follow the development of the ionospheric layers, and also we could measure the height of those, we used to sound normally every quarter of an hour on the ionosonde, but then we did measurements of absorption, and there were special days when we did extra runs. What we could tell was the effect of, as one might expect, of the effect of sunlight on the upper atmosphere. But also we began to study the effect of sunspots, because there was a degree of correlation between the aurora and what we used to call blackout, when you couldn't see anything because the absorption was so high, low down. Mm. So we were able to measure the E layer, F1, F2, and the amount of absorption. So it was all.
But were some of these figures taking you by surprise? Was it exactly what you expected?
In quiet conditions, is what more or less what we expected. What we didn't know was how the ionosphere would behave in a magnetic storm. That is when the sunspots. Particles from the sunspots hit the Earth's magnetic field, how they interface with that. You see, Halley Bay was a very fortunate position because we were at high latitude, 75, 35, but at the same time, the magnetic latitude, that is, from the magnetic pole, was very low. It was about 60, if I recall, 66. So we could separate things which were due to the sun exposure from those which were due to the sunspots.
So your equipment was able to tell you when sunspot activity was happening?
Yes. We we were just outside the auroral zone at Halley Bay, and the result is that when you get magnetic activity, the auroral zone expands, and so we came directly under it, and you could see this effect quite easily from the what was happening with the upper layers.
How reliable was the equipment you were using?
Well, I would say very reliable.
Oh.
Mm. You mean from a breakdown point of view?
Mm.
Yes.
Mm.
The the ionosonde was the one that gave us more trouble than anything. We had a big transmitter for the absorption, more powerful one, which was handmade at Radio and Space Research Station. And that never gave us much trouble at all. But we, you know, there was always the calibrations to be done to make sure that what you were seeing was what was happening.
What were you doing with the information you got? Were you able to then send it straight back to the rest of the planet, so to speak? Was it going back to London?
No. We never sent back detailed information. But we wrote up what we were seeing, and that was sent back.
On a yearly basis?
From Halley Bay. Communications were very difficult at times, unreliable. But I think, as I said in my answer to the questionnaire, the radio operators were using Morse code at that time with Port Stanley, and they could often work through terrible conditions. Terrible ionospheric conditions, anyway.
Mm.
And of course, if they missed a part, they could ask for a repeat, you know.
Mm.
So, yes, we weren't that isolated in that sense, but... And we also had a circuit with London at times, but that was very unreliable. I think that was the BBC, actually, at that time.
Were you aware of what was happening to the information once it got to London? So were you seeing both sides of the process, not only the gathering of the information, but also how useful it was to other people later?
Yes. Because Pickett, Dr. Pickett, at Radio and Space, he was the expert on Antarctic upper atmosphere. And he would write back to me. And also he wrote a paper which he gave me credit for while I was still down there.
Did they get out much?
I did.
Did you? Because it wasn't really a sledging station, was it?
No. That was the trouble. To start with, of course, none of us had any Antarctic experience. Even the base leader, Colonel Smart, only had, I think, a fortnight up in Canada, northern Canada. And it surprises me, thinking back, that the Royal Society could consider putting 22 people down there with no experience of the Antarctic, none of them, and expect them to stay in their huts, you know. So the first thing I did in my spare time was to go on a long ski trip. We went down the coast, three of us, skied down on the great distance, 17 miles, I think it was. But at least it gave us some exercise, and Jim, the meteorologist, or one of the meteorologists, he put up snowdrift stakes so we could measure them again, see what the drift was. So it was... but then I got, I suppose, a bit more ambitious. I wanted a sledge we could take a tent on and stay overnight. And there was no sledge. There were two, well, not two, there were several little six-foot sledges for carting boxes around the dump. I decided to build a sledge in my spare time.
Describe it to me.
Sorry?
Describe it to me.
It was a, well, first of all, I had to get the runners because, and I got the runners from two of these small, because that was hickory. And I decided, because the there was hard sastrugi, that it was better to have a rigid sledge that you could bounce over the sastrugi. Otherwise, if with these flexible sledges, which Fitz used to use, that the nose, you to dig in, you have to lift it up and push again, and then the next level, you'd be in it again, you know. And so I decided to build like a Greenlander's sledge. And... the only thing that worried me was joining these two runners together to make a long runner. All I had was Araldite. And so I tried to make as good a butt joint to this joint. And it lasted. And so that was the sledge that we used. So we were able to then go travelling for 3 or 4 days.
This was all manhole, wasn't it?
Manhole. Mm. Mm. Yes. But great fun.
Any snags on the way? Did you hit any crevasses or...?
We got down to the crevasses between the crevassed area to the south, but the only time I fell down a crevasse was near the base.
What happened?
I was walking with two others and just out for a bit of exercise. And I was walking along, lighting my pipe in the lead. And suddenly, down I went. But fortunately, there was a snow bridge. And I landed down this snow bridge. With their help, I managed to scramble out. But I often felt the snow bridge was going. my own fault. I wasn't looking where I'd gone. Because there was a bridge on top. And that's what I broke through. Now, I should have seen that. Seen the signs of it anyway. But then I landed on the lower snow bridge. No, I was more annoyed I lost my matches.
Well, just to digress for a moment... Were there any regulations about smoking pipes inside an Antarctic hut or smoking anything inside an Antarctic hut? Because fire was always a worry, wasn't it?
Oh, we had fire drills and that. Mm.
But you didn't have to go outside for a cigarette?
No.
Or a pipe?
No. Lots of the lads used to smoke cigarettes, which I dislike.
Mm. So these manhole homemade sledges. You went out for 3 or 4 days. Did you? Yeah. It was purely recreational, or were you doing some research work as well?
No, I wouldn't say research work, but we were doing some observations. What we were trying to originally look for was a way up the Dawson Lambton Glacier, a so-called. It's not a glacier, it's the overspill of the ice onto the shelf there. But it was thought to be a glacier. And certainly it has a glacier front into the sea. We used to do, always we took a meteorologist with us. And he used to do wind speed measurements and accumulation studies. On one occasion, we decided we'd go for a week. That was going to be special. And the second night over the... ice shell. We experienced the wind rising. And you could see these little whirlies. I don't know if you've ever seen them. Like little tornadoes, and they run around. Mm. And I thought, I'd never seen them before. But I thought, well, that's indicative of a storm coming. So we decided to pitch a tent, and by then it was really raging. The tents had a leaf that came out, and you could pile snow on those, you see, keep the tent. But of course, the wind was so strong it was blowing the snow away as quick, We had to keep going outside to put more snow on. Jim, who was measuring the wind speed, he had a hand anemometer. And the last reading he got before it broke was 80 knots. So we were there 2 days, I think. Wondering we were making plans for what to do if the tent went, because clearly there was that likelihood any time. But anyway, we hung on, and suddenly it dropped. But that was really the end of our trip. We'd lost too much time.
All right.
So we had to come back.
Hmm. Just going back a little bit, in your notes you very kindly supplied, you talk about the first year, 57, was the most memorable. Our scientific observations were very exciting as we discovered new phenomena.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted to ask you that question. I don't think we quite got to the end of it, did we? So what were you discovering that was breaking new ground with your, I presume, your ionospheric work?
Yeah. Well, we could, we were able to see the effects of the magnetic activity, because that was being measured separately, but we could we could see the decrease in the ionization at one level and the increase at another. So these were, when I say level, I mean height. In the UK, you never see these effects. And how quickly they occur sometimes. Looking back, one of the things we used to do was to make what was called an F plot.
A what?
An F for Freddy plot. That was a frequency plot.
Okay.
And so we had time along the bottom, frequency going up, and we could plot the critical frequencies of the various layers on this F plot every quarter of an hour throughout the day. And then you could compare this with the previous day and so on, and you could see how the changes came about. And so we were able to get a picture of the onset of radiation from the sunspots to the time the magnetic field calmed down again.
Mm. And this was all groundbreaking stuff because
it was.
It hadn't been done in the Antarctic before.
No.
Did it feel important at the time? Did you have a sense of special occasion about it all, or was it just what you did?
Only that, I didn't think I was being particularly clever or anything, but I was aware that we were making the observations which were of value.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, I had two other fellows with me on working on the ionosphere.
Was the work you were doing going to change the way we went about organising our communications on the planet?
Well, it's possible, but you see the start of Sputnik changed everything.
How do you mean?
Well, satellite communications came into being.
Right.
I mean, we were able to track Sputnik down there because we were at such a high latitude. We could get the various track bearings of Sputnik every time it came around and so on. There was a lot to be learnt, but I think, and this was a decision I made in later years, was that to give up ionospheric research because of satellites. I mean, the reliability of satellites services is today is. I mean, they can send information back in real time from Ali Bay to Cambridge. Something we could never have done.
Let's just pause for a moment and just change the tape. Thank you.